Welcome to the Federalist Society Annual Convention. My name is Tim Timkovich, and I'm a judge on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, so it's good to escape the Rocky Mountain West for the Beltway every once in a while. And I want to do a shout-out for many of my former clerks that came to the panel today. I didn't know so many labor and employment lawyers were there, but we're happy to see you. The topic today is labor, employment, and the new administration. I had a sort of interesting aspect to this year in Colorado. As many of you know, Colorado has the initiative and referendum process. And this year, we had an interesting political debate on labor and employment issues. One group, Citizens Initiative group, put on the Colorado ballot several initiatives that would be construed as possibly pro-employer or anti-union, a right to work and paycheck protection initiative. In response to those initiatives, the other side, union groups, put on several initiatives that would have imposed mandates on employers and had other effects. So these four or five measures made it onto the ballot, and as somebody might have suspected, it was labor versus employer Armageddon, perhaps. And the committees geared up, the political committees, and millions of dollars started to flow into the state, both for and against these initiatives. In August, the proponents of all of these initiatives realized that, hey, some might pass, some might fail, but collectively there's going to be a lot of losers in the state if they all pass. And interestingly enough, you had the labor forces and the Chamber of Commerce, employer forces, joining together to defeat all of the measures. And Colorado is a battleground state. It was interesting, every third commercial involved some aspect of labor and employment issue, because we had a very hotly contested Senate race. But the millions of dollars that flowed into this were particularly interesting. There were five or six ballot initiatives, and some were pro-labor, some were anti-labor. And the commercials that were run said, vote no, 47, 49, 52, 53. But the commercials never said what the issue was about. So the voters were left scratching their head, but they knew it was the end of the republic if any one of them passed. And they all went down in flames, some more than the other. But we had an interesting experience of, I guess, the lambs and the lions, depending on your point of view, lying down together and working together on some issues. But with the Democrats and the new president-elect in control of both houses of Congress and the presidency for the first time since 1994, broad changes in labor policy appear to be on the horizon. President-elect Barack Obama has both supported labor policies as well as made campaign promises to push those policies, including are the president-elect's support of major policy initiatives that the panel will discuss, including the Employee Free Choice Act, the Respect Act, and expanded coverage under the Family Medical Leave Act, as well as numerous others. During the this election cycle, a couple of salient political points might be observed. First of all, union workers overwhelmingly supported President-elect Obama at the polling places, according to one report, voting 60% to 30% for Senator Obama over Senator McCain. Secondly, most of the major unions endorsed Senator-elect Obama, including the AFL-CIO. In addition, unions made a significant financial contribution during this election cycle, with some reports totaling the amount of donations and expenditures reaching as much as $450 million, which is about double what labor spent or donated in the 2004 election cycle. And finally, on top of that financial contribution would be millions of phone calls to voters, outreach to voters, and sponsorship of rallies and events. with these new policies, initiatives in place, and a new administration coming to Washington, we've put together a distinguished panel to give their observations and expectations on these topics. Our first speaker to my right is James Peretti. Mr. Peretti is Workforce Policy Counsel to the United States House of Representatives Committee on Education and Labor for the Minority Party. He is responsible for legal and policy oversight of workforce issues before the committee, including labor and employment laws, health care, pension, and welfare policy. Mr. Peretti has previously worked on the Hill and has practiced in the area of labor and employment for several national law firms. He has extensive experience in labor relations, collective bargaining, negotiations, and grievance arbitration. He's a graduate of Harvard College and earned his law degree from New York University. Our second speaker this afternoon is William Samuel. Mr. Samuel is the Director of Government Affairs at the AFL-CIO, serving as the chief lobbyist for the 9 million-member Labor Federation. Mr. Samuel also chairs the AFL-CIO's Legislative Committee. He previously served in the Clinton administration as Associate Deputy Secretary of Labor, and he later served with Vice President Al Gore as his, as his principal advisor on labor policy. We're going to go back to that that election. Huh? Mr. Samuel also served as the chief lobbyist at the United Mine Workers of America. He's a graduate of Oberlin College and the George Washington University Law Center. Our third speaker this afternoon is William Kilberg. Mr. Kilberg is currently senior partner in the Labor and Employment Group at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher here in Washington, D.C. In the past, Mr. Kilberg served as solicitor for the Department of the of Labor in 1973, and before that was a White House fellow with one of my current colleagues, Chief Judge Donnell Taha. He serves in numerous labor and employment-related organizations and is an officer of the Labor and Employment Committee of this group, the Federalist Society. He's published books and articles in the field and is a frequent speaker on these topics. He's argued two cases before the Supreme Court and numerous cases before the Courts of Appeal, including, gratefully, the Tenth Circuit. He's a graduate of Cornell University and attended Harvard Law School. While at Cornell, I'm told he was a Local 3 International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers scholarship recipient. Congratulations. Our last speaker is Holly Fechner. Ms. Fechner is a member of Covington and Burling's Government Affairs Practice Group. She has over 18 years of legal, legislative, and public policy experience in both the public and private sectors. Most recently, Ms. Fechner was policy director for Senator Edward Kennedy, and was also the Chief Labor and Pensions Counsel for the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee. Ms. Fechner served as the Chief Negotiator on federal legislation to reform private pensions, the private pension system, increase the federal minimum wage, extend unemployment insurance benefits, and other important policy initiatives. Ms. Fechner is also a graduate of Oberlin College and the University of Michigan Law School. With that, we're going to have some opening remarks from each of our speakers, and then we'll open up to the floor for a question and answer period. With that, Mr. Peretti.
Thank you, Judge. Again, it's Jim Peretti, and thank you for having us and bearing with us this morning as we give our views on what may or may not be coming down the pike. When first asked to present, it was sort of the labor issues of emerging in the Obama administration or in the next administration. I think it is important to sort of, as a preliminary matter, look and see exactly, you know, how hand in glove Congress and the administration are going to be able to work here. President-elect Obama has supporting him two very strong chairmen on his labor committees, Ted Kennedy, obviously, and maybe only slightly lesser known, George Miller of California, who was an early and active supporter of the president-elect. Both are considered masterful senior negotiators and known for getting what they want and getting their jobs done. So I do think President Obama will come in January with a strong support in the House for his initiatives and in the Senate, folks working for him. And I think it is my strong sense that they're going to take to the ground and move pretty quickly on a number of key issues. when thinking about the issues of labor and employment issues that will be presented in the next administration, you can think of sort of what legislatively will happen, what will we see on an administrative regulatory side, and then finally, what might we expect from agencies in terms of National Labor Relations Board, things of that sort. I will try to focus, since I have a short period of time, on the legislative side, maybe touch on some of the agency stuff, and perhaps some of my colleagues can fill in the gaps on the regulatory side. First and foremost, I think the single largest, you know, the elephant in the room on labor issues will be the so-called Employee Free Choice Act, card check, EFCO, however you're going to refer to it. That has been made a front and center campaign issue by the president during the campaign. Business has recognized the challenge that they're going to face here and are rallying their forces, and folks are talking about this sort of being the first big Donnybrook of the administration. Remains to be seen whether President Obama will lead with this, as some have counseled very strongly that he should enact this in his first 100 days. Others have suggested that they may want to wait, start with more general economic recovery, work to try to make some relationship with business before they go. I suspect it'll come up sooner rather than later, and you know, given the numbers, it's not a hard guess. It will clear the House, and you will end up having a battle in the Senate. Sitting here today, the Senate is sitting with 58 Democrats, 40 Republicans, and two open seats, one of which at least is completely, you know, too close to call. In the past, you've also had at least one Republican senator support cloture on the Employee Free Choice Act, Senator Spector of Pennsylvania. So we could be, depending on where Senator Spector is returning to the table, 58-59, you are within one or two striking votes of obtaining cloture on that bill, which was supported by every Democrat in the Senate when it was brought up back in 2007. So we can talk more as the panel continues about some of the details of that bill, what's contained in it, but certainly I think on the traditional labor relations side, the Employee Free Choice Act is, by everybody's agreement, labor's number one priority, and I expect to be the one that the Obama administration works hardest on. Maybe a second to that would be the so-called Respect Act, which purports to overturn the Oakwood Healthcare trilogy of cases in the National Labor Relations Act and would essentially change the statutory definition of who is a supervisor and excluded from the Act's coverage. That was considered in our committee. We prepared to file a report on it, but for reasons I'm not fully sure I understand, that one was not brought to the House for consideration. On the National Labor Relations Act side also, I would expect we may see some executive orders on things repealing back, requiring project labor agreements. I expect the National Labor Relations Board will, which has recently had become more of a bit of a ping pong as administrations change. We will see probably a reexamination of the Dana Metaldine case, as well as things like graduate student organizing, very possibly Weingarten rights, which has always, of recent years, been a 3-2 issue. So that, just if we were looking at the National Labor Relations Act, LMRDA, and those things, I would say that's a very full plate. But that, I would argue, is the tip of the iceberg. On the what I'll call the civil rights, equal EEOC side, I think the number one priority there for the next administration will be enactment of the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Law. Those of you who followed that one, that's a bill that purports to overturn the Supreme Court's 5-4 ruling in the Ledbetter case. I will say, to their credit, supporters of that bill have very nicely tied that bill's substance and story to the Equal Pay Act and Fair Pay for Women. You might have seen campaign ads run, you know, John McCain does not support equal pay for women. I would submit that whatever your feelings are on the Ledbetter bill and what that bill does, it's not an Equal Pay Act bill. It's a statute of limitations bill. But when we looked at that one last year, went through the House, we lost two Democrats and we picked up six Democrats but lost two Republicans. Senate cloture on that one was 56-42 with six Republicans picked up. So given the new numbers, I suspect that bill has a far greater chance of sailing through the Senate and heading to the White House, where I expect President Obama will sign it. An open question remains whether they will tie the Ledbetter issue, as they've done in sort of messaging, whether as a matter of substance Ledbetter will get tied to Equal Pay Act amendments, Fair Paycheck Act, comparable worth issues. I mean, in the past, those have moved to separate vehicles, but I think as the issues have been conflated, there may be some attempt to sort of bootstrap onto Lilly Ledbetter, which presents a very compelling story and is a very compelling presence, to bootstrap additional changes there. Second tier, likely looking at some return to Civil Rights Act stuff. Eliminating the damage caps is one that we've heard talked about. I think mandatory arbitration of employment disputes is going to come under increased attack. And I would suggest we'll probably see some resurrection of the ENDA, Employee Non-Discrimination Act, a sexual orientation bill. That last year had passed on sexual orientation but got hung up on the issue of gender identity. Lower-tier items might be workplace religious freedom, some addressing some of those cases that have been out there. Moving to, I guess, the third area, I think Holly may have mentioned it, Family Medical Leave Act and expanded leave entitlements. I suspect we'll see a push for paid sick leave in the workforce. I think Senator Kennedy has made that long a sort of signature issue of his, and he's coming back to do some good work, so I suspect that we will see shortly. Sort of sub-tier, I expect we'll see proposals to expand the categories of leave for which Family and Medical Leave Act leave can be taken, as well as the number of covered employees, be it reducing the size of employers, reducing or eliminating hour thresholds. We've seen bills in this Congress that would, you know, apply the Family Medical Leave Act to all employees, part-time, flexible schedule, other. So I suspect we will see that there. As a side note, I'm not going to talk today about what I consider to be employee issues such as health care and pension and retirement security. I think both of those we will see active agendas again. My chairman, George Miller, has made very clear he intends to legislate aggressively in those areas. We could talk 2 hours about them, but I think our focus today is a little more narrow. Continuing down my tick list, and if I run a little bit long, my colleagues will understand we've got a lot to do. I think you'll see serious efforts at OSHA reform, both strengthening the agency, overhauling whistleblower protections, more targeted rulemakings. On the wage and hour side, the longstanding proposals have been to increase and or index the minimum wage. I suspect we may return to that. I would expect to see increased focus both from the agency itself and on the legislative front on designation as independent contractors, whether the classification issue or misclassification issue, where depending on where you come to the table. Maybe some raising of the minimum salaries for some of the exempt categories. And finally, I guess in the broad areas, WARN Act legislation and reform has always been, you know, bandied about in recent years, particularly when we were looking at sort of economic, when you get to the issues of outsourcing, economic recovery, which I expect will be immediately on the new president's agenda. Mr. Miller and others have proposals to expand the length of times under the WARN Act, expand the coverage of it. I would be surprised if we didn't see at least some of those peeking their heads up as we, you know, contemplate broader packages. So with that, I think my time is ticked, and I will hand it over to my able colleague.
Summary. Let's turn now to Bill Sandman. Thank you.
Okay. So Jim took the easy way out. He just listed all the issues that are.
I figured I'd tee them up, and now you can tell us which ones are going
to. And now
I
had to describe my job is to try to sell you on any of them, sell this audience on any. If I can convince you to support any of them, I will consider myself to be a complete success. So let me just say one word first, though, about the union vote. I think people look at these, you know, big numbers of dollars spent, and they think somehow we were, you know, sticking dollar bills in people's pockets or buying the election. In fact, the results are actually very interesting if you drop down to the next level. It is true that 67% of union members voted for Barack Obama, 30% for John McCain. But what's interesting is the money we spend is to educate what we consider educate our members through worksite flyers, phone calls, knocking on doors. And that's the money goes for that. We don't give money to the campaign to do commercials. We don't do our own commercials. There were some 527s, but the AFL-CIO did not contribute to those. So we do this very comprehensive communication to our members. The more we talk to them, and we can plot this out on a graph, the pollsters do, and you can see in the first week of September we weren't anywhere near 67% for Barack Obama. Most of our members hadn't heard of him, and if they had, they were probably not impressed because of what I would say was misinformation about him. And there was a lot of support for John McCain. He's a very popular figure, very compelling story. But as we began to talk through the mail, flyers, union newsletters, those results began to change. And what's interesting about the union vote is if you look at some of the demographics, for example, gun owners who are union members voted with a 25-point margin for Obama. If they weren't union members, it was 25 points the other way. So I think the effect we have on union members through this communication, mostly at work, I mean, they're the phone calls and the leaflets, but we like to think it's the conversation that goes on between stewards and union activists and their fellow workers. If you were 65 or older, general public was with McCain by 8 points. If you were a union member, you were for Barack Obama by 46 points. White men, McCain won them by 16 points. Barack Obama won white union men by 18 points. So we like to say if you were gun-owning, church-going, white male, you were still more likely to vote for Obama than if you were a union member than if you were not. So that's sort of what we're about in elections, and I think we've developed a pretty good program there. As far as agendas, as I said, Jim, you know, got it mostly right. The Employee Free Choice Act is, I suppose, the 800-pound gorilla or whatever the expression is, elephant in the room. I would imagine the Federalist Society believes very strongly in democracy. It's something that we all believe is our heritage. And that's actually why we're for the Employee Free Choice Act. We feel that the decision for the union, everybody's shaking their heads already, I haven't said anything. Could you keep that door open so I can just make a beeline right
like
out?
A friendly room,
or maybe I'll turn over to Holly now. You know, people talk about the secret ballot election. We know the tradition, obviously. The problem is, in the union context, only one side gets to campaign. You all know that when a union when workers are deciding whether or not to form a union, they're on the employer's payroll and property 8 hours a day. The employer has complete access. The union really has none. The union is not allowed on the property. Union supporters can talk to their coworkers at lunch on breaks, but there's really not a right to free speech in the workplace. You know that. There can be any number of captive audience meetings. Supervisors can pull workers aside, particularly those that he or she knows might be favorable, and have as many conversations as they want. They can have, you know, over a 6, 8, 12-week period. That's a lot of conversation, all directed at dissuading the worker from supporting the union. The CEO can call all the workers together multiple times, and they do that. You all know, maybe you're working for firms that specialize in this activity. It's a huge business now. I've seen estimates as much as $4 billion are spent in these union avoidance programs that companies sponsor. So when you talk about democracy, you know, normally you think of the secret ballot, and there's this kind of free exchange of ideas. Everybody has equal access to the voters. People get to ask questions. They get to get answers. People can raise money. There's some equivalence of money spent on communication. No side really has any coercive powers. It's interesting that under the federal election law, employers aren't supposed to talk to workers about who they should vote for. It's interesting that under the FEC, that's the rule. And I wonder why that is. It's because of the inherently coercive relationship that an employer has with his or her workers. That's not at all true in this other so-called election context, the union election. Employers can say anything they want practically. I understand there are things they're not supposed to say, they're not supposed to threaten, unless they can back it up with some economic or financial proof that they might have to close or move. But basically, the rules are very different. So when I talk to political leaders and they say, well, why the heck are you doing away with the secret ballot election? I mean, isn't that part of the American tradition? Well, the secret ballot election assumes that there is this, you know, environment of free choice. And we believe, and I'm sure we'll get into a long debate about this, that there's no such thing. The workers are frightened. They're threatened. If I was running against a bill here for Congress or school board, in the civic context, we each have campaign managers and flyers and lists of voters. We'd go down to the Board of Elections and get the voting rolls. Well, in the union context, I don't get to know who the voters are until a couple of weeks before the election. He could and may fire my campaign manager, my press secretary, my lead political operative. That happens in a lot of campaigns. A big debate about how often. We've seen numbers as high as in a quarter of campaigns the lead union supporters get fired. He would control the hours of my staff, the duties, the location. I mean, you know, the employer has a lot of control. Think of yourselves as employers. Think of your employer. You know, what is the relationship between you and your workers? The political campaign is nothing like the campaign that a union has to go through. And there isn't a county sheriff, congressman, or senator who would put up with the same rules and conditions and run for office that a union has to prior to this so-called secret ballot election. So that's really our main argument. Now, there's a whole other argument I can make about the value of unions in our society. And maybe I should have started there, because it may be that there are people here who don't really see that. You know, we think that the 20th century, we saw a pretty good balance between labor, business, and management. Everybody grew together. When companies made money, so did workers. You could chart on a graph the productivity increases that continued through the post-war period. Wages went up at the same time, almost at the exact same rate. Unions had the ability then to bargain for a piece of that of the profits that were earned due to that productivity, and everybody grew together. Well, starting in the 1970s, due to globalization, due to, we think, a much more aggressive anti-union business outlook, union density began to level off. And wages have been flat ever since. And that, I think, is what Barack Obama was talking about when he said wages have flatlined because workers have lost the ability to bargain for higher wages and benefits. So there's, I think, a very compelling economic case to strengthen unions. There are all kinds of other issues that we think come from stronger unions, workplace healthy, safety and health. There are a lot of things that we would not be enjoying today had it not been for the labor movement. You've all seen the sticker, you know, the folks that brought you the weekend, the 40-hour week, safe workplaces. One could argue Social Security and Medicare were unemployment insurance, employer-provided health care, things that you all enjoy that employers were not on their own giving to workers prior to the growth of the labor movement and an activist government. And we may part ways on a lot of this stuff, but that's how we see the world. I've probably taken more than 5 minutes. I have lots more to say, but I'll...
You're right on time, Bill.
Right on time, okay.
Mr. Kilberg.
It comes no surprise that Bill and I don't agree on a number of things. Let me address first the timing and where I think the EFCA is going to go and what I think some of the dangers are. I think the administration is going to be a little concerned about pushing EFCA too quickly on its legislative agenda, because it can be a gaze in the military problem for them, much like for the Clinton administration. Or perhaps a better analogy is labor law reform in the Carter administration. And I say that because, A, I don't think that the arguments in favor of it are very strong, and secondly, because I think the legislation itself is overreaching. The notion that only 7.5% of the workforce, private sector workforce, are union members solely because of employer coercion ignores realities that we all see. The reality of very extensive government protections at the federal level, at state level, at local level. The realities and the changes that we've seen in the economy and the movement away from a industrial economy to one that is more of a service economy, just to name two. The arguments in favor of it also fail the statistical test. It is not true, and there is no evidence that employees are fired in 25% of all union organizing campaigns. That's a statistic that comes from a union study of union organizers, and it was an estimate given by union organizers. So it tends to be exaggerated. If you look at data from the National Labor Relations Board, you find that most unfair labor practice complaints brought to the board alleging illegal campaign tactics are withdrawn or dismissed. In 2005, the National Labor Relations Board found substantial evidence of illegal firings in 2.7% of organizing elections in that year, and that's a pretty constant number. Similarly, you find that unions win 60% of elections, and that's a pretty constant number. The data just came out with regard to fiscal year 2007, and it was you know, about 63, I think 64% in 2005, it was 61, 2004, it was 57, so it ranges about 60%. Similarly, median time for an election is 39 days after a petition is filed. In 94% of cases, an election is held within 8 weeks. So the arguments in favor of the need for some dramatic reform, I would suggest, are somewhat exaggerated. A concern is that with the Congress constituted as it will be on January 20th, and with the president-elect's strong support for EFCA as a co-sponsor, we may find compromise which is not a whole lot better. Most of the compromises that have been articulated, at least by people on the union side, as potential compromises, take us back to the Carter labor law reform bills of 1977-78. They provide for quickie elections. They would allow unions onto the employer's work site to campaign whenever an employer speaks to his employees, and provisions like that. There's also been no suggestion of compromise on what is the most serious part of the EFCA, which is the arbitration provision in the bill. It's not the card check. It's the notion that the failure to get a first contract will result in an arbitrated agreement by an arbitration board or panel, it's referred to both ways in the legislation, selected by the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service under rules yet to be written by the Mediation Service, so that we're going to have an arbitrator draft the first agreement, and that agreement would stay in effect for 2 years. And that undercuts everything that any of us were taught in law school about the National Labor Relations Act and its purposes and the notion that we are supporting an opportunity for free collective bargaining where the parties decide, not the NLRB, not an arbitrator, not the mediation service, but the parties decide what will be in their collective bargaining agreement. So I think we're in for a rough haul. I don't think EFCA will be the first thing that the administration tries to achieve. But I think clearly the Democrats and the union movement have the upper hand, and we're in for a tough time. Let me just mention a couple of other bills that Jim did not mention, which at least are pending now and may be reintroduced in the new Congress. You've got the Patriot Employer Act, which the president-elect talked about a great deal during his campaign. He always talked about one provision of the act, which is to reward employers with lower taxes if they create more jobs in the United States than they do overseas. He neglected to mention another requirement in order to get that reduction in taxes, and that is that an employer adopt a union-neutral employment policy. So there's this strong push to silence employers. And to do it in a variety of, to come at it in a variety of different ways. We talked about the Healthy Families Act, which would provide 7 days of paid leave in the event of sickness or illness of an employee or a family member. It's interesting to look at that bill. Family member is defined as anyone whose close association with the employee is the equivalent of a family relationship. Should provide for some interesting litigation down the road. The Working Families Flexibility Act, which Senator Obama had co-sponsored along with Senator Kennedy, provides or would provide employees with an annual right to request changes to work hours, schedules, or locations, and such other matters as the Department of Labor might, in its wisdom, provide in regulation. The employer would have 14 days to meet with the employee, 14 more days to provide a written decision explaining decision to reject an employee's request. The employee has a right to a representative of his or her choosing. and the employee can request reconsideration, must be provided another meeting. Any discrimination or retaliation against the employee is reviewable in a federal district court. Talked about Lilly Ledbetter Act, we're all familiar with that. Comparable worth, as Jim mentioned, may be tied into that. The comparable worth notion, which all of us thought of as a 1970s bill that went nowhere, is back. There is a Fair Pay Act, which Senator Harkin introduced in this Congress, that would provide equal pay for unequal jobs that involve comparable skill, effort, responsibility, and working conditions. That, along with the Paycheck Fairness Act, which would limit various Equal Pay Act defenses and provide unlimited punitive and compensatory damages, is another bill that, if reintroduced in the next Congress, I think ought to give us all some concern and some pause.
Thank you. Ms. Becker.
Judge, thank you so much, and I really appreciate the opportunity of being here today, particularly with such a distinguished group of panelists. First off, I want to offer a disclaimer, which is that what I'm doing here is, I think, trying to filter what I see as President-elect Obama's labor and employment agenda through my many years on the Hill with Senator Kennedy working on these issues, but in no way am I representing the transition or the new administration, as I'm sure everybody up here would agree that is our situation. I think what I want to do, because a lot of the speakers have talked about some of the specific agenda items, is to try to stand back and maybe characterize how I see President-elect Obama looking at labor and employment issues, and then maybe talk about some other issues that haven't been mentioned yet. But as I compare the way he talked about these issues throughout the campaign with other past Democratic candidates, a few things stood out to me, and I just want to share with you what I saw and how I think he's looking at these issues. I think one thing is clear is that his agenda on these issues is very robust, but it's also quite focused. He doesn't just sort of throw out the kitchen sink. You know, I'm going to address these 1,000 labor and employment issues that people haven't been focused. I think it's very much like he does everything. So he's taking on some of the challenging issues. He's taking on the labor management, unionization, car check, arbitration issues. But he's picking and choosing his battles, I guess, is how I would put it. The other thing I noticed is that his work on labor and employment seems to be very integrated with his message on the overall economy. And the idea that this is not some discrete area of law sitting off over in a corner, but it's part of one of the biggest challenges that he has, which is to get this economy moving again. The other thing that I noticed is that in a number of respects, what I think he's trying to do is modernize labor and employment law and make them much more reflective of what the current workforce is like. So let me talk about a number of other issues, I think, that we haven't really covered. First off, let's talk about the economy, because it's true, when Congress comes back, when the president comes into office in January, one of the very first things that's going to be on his plate is dealing with this very serious economic slowdown that we have. And he's already said that one of his first orders of business is going to be to go to the Hill with not just an economic stimulus plan, but truly something that he's calling an economic recovery plan. And I think the order of magnitude that people are talking about is immense. He's talked about addressing taxes in this too. I think what's relevant for this group particularly is that in his campaign, he talked about a lot of different ways that we could create jobs in this country. And I think that first bill, the economic recovery plan, could be a means, a way to try to do some of the work that he's talked about. And I, what I'm suggesting are things like this idea of infrastructure, transportation, communications infrastructure. He's talked a lot about bringing manufacturing back in this company, along with this idea of freedom from dependence on foreign oil. He's talked about creating a whole new workforce of green jobs, and you know, we can talk more about what exactly that means. But certainly, places like the Department of Labor and many companies and organizations are going to be involved in rethinking what these jobs might look like. How do we get people ready for the new jobs? So I think right off the bat, in terms of what he needs to do, what the Congress needs to do, we'll be talking a lot about jobs, job creation. Going along with that initial package, just yesterday, the Congress passed an extension of unemployment insurance, which I think, unfortunately, is going to be something on the plate for quite a while to come. But something that President-elect Obama has talked about in relation to unemployment insurance is the idea of modernizing it and making it more responsive to the current workforce. I think people in this room understand what a critical role that unemployment insurance plays in terms of stimulating the economy. Because it is a countercyclical program, people are unemployed, it kicks in, people have money in their pockets, they spend it to spur the economy. And what he has noticed is a problem with the program is that because of the changing workforce over time, the program doesn't do exactly what it's intended because there are a lot of workers that it doesn't cover, particularly workers like part-time workers and low-wage workers because of some of the particular ways that the programs are structured. A lot of workers are left out. So he certainly has said that that is one thing he wants to do. We've touched on the minimum wage. The next increase, the final increase of the bill that was passed will go into effect next summer. That will raise the minimum wage to $7.25 an hour. He has talked about going to $9.50 an hour in 2011 and then indexing it from there. So even though that won't be right off the bat, that certainly will be on the table. I think one of the most creative and innovative policy areas in labor and employment law that President-elect Obama has put time into is the work family area. And I think it is different in the respect of what I talked about, how it's robust but focused. This work family agenda actually is robust and has a lot of parts to it. So I think that's sort of the one exception that I would say to my own categorization, really throwing out a lot of ideas about work-family. I think he's trying to be responsive to women voters. I think he's trying to look like he is part of a new generation of leadership, people who really do appreciate that women moving into the workforce, the paid workforce, is probably the most significant demographic change that our economy has undergone during this past century. But in addition to the paid sick days, which he has supported, the various different permutations of expanding the FMLA, covering more workers, covering them for more reasons to leave, he also has this idea of a fund, I think it's $1.5 billion fund, to allow states to experiment with various different types of paid family and medical leave. As Bill talked about, he has spoken in favor of ideas like flexible work schedules. How can the government work with employers to provide more flexibility? Telecommuting is certainly something that he's talked about. And a number of other speakers have talked about his agenda on equal pay and the Ledbetter bill. But I guess one thing I would notice is that really a lot of it does go back to the campaign, having a historic primary with the first very serious woman candidate for president. He, I think, put quite a bit of energy into the campaign of appealing to women. Clearly, Democrats win when the gender gap is fairly significant. He knew that. He knew he needed to appeal particularly to women. The last area I wanted to touch on, which I think will be a real change from the current administration, is his seeming interest in federal employees. He has made some statements. He has suggested that federal employees really will be partners in all that he wants to do as president. People may have noticed the Washington Post had a story just this very week about a series of letters that he sent to federal employees talking about their specific agencies and what he wanted to accomplish working with them. I think he's a president who realizes that the federal government is not in the business of making widgets. Really, it's human resources. It's federal employees are one of the most effective ways that he can accomplish his agenda. So I think I thought that was it was pretty interesting that he did has made a number of statements and did send that series of letters. And I think finally what that leads into, which we haven't talked a lot about, is the nature of increased enforcement, regulation and re-regulation of areas that have been deregulated. It just astounds me to see any public official, including Democrats for many years here, actually talk about regulation and use the word regulation as if it's a good thing. I think the financial crisis has opened that door in ways that it hasn't been open for many years now. But we could talk more about that, but certainly I do think that there will be a robust regulatory and enforcement agenda.
Thank you, Holly. I hope that appreciation for federal employees includes the federal judiciary.
With that, we can open the floor to questions from the audience, and we have a microphone set up. So if you have a question, just step up to the microphone and I'll recognize you. One question before we get to you, sir. I just wondered if Bill Samuel wanted to respond at all to Bill Kilburn.
I'll ask a question and try not to make it a loaded one. So the number of back pay awards has been climbing. The National Labor Relations Board issues back pay awards when an employer violates the certain parts of the National Labor Relations Act. So it's one of the only real penalties that the board can issue. The others involve posting notices on employee work bulletin boards to say they won't commit this act again. But back pay awards obviously is a more serious. And it now routinely is $20,000, $30,000 a year. Back in the 1960s, it was $1,200 a year, $1,500 a year. Now, I'm not saying these are all back pay awards because someone got fired for organizing. I'm not saying that. But it's a pretty serious penalty nonetheless. And so my question is there anything about the National Labor Relations Act that needs fixing?
Bill?
Or is it working just fine?
I think it's working pretty well. As you indicated, the number of back pay awards, the total number of workers given back pay during the course of a year involves all kinds of disputes, not all of them discrimination and illegal firings. If you look at a more interesting statistic to get at the issue that you're seeking to address with the EFCA, you would look at reinstatement. That's the remedy that you think of when somebody's been illegally fired. They're put back. I mean, the purpose of the NLRA, at least up to now, wouldn't be under the EFCA, but up to now has been a make-whole statute. And last year, that number was 2008, and that really hasn't changed much.
But there's a lot less organizing going on through the National Labor Relations Act.
fewer elections.
You know, there is less organizing going on, but I think if you looked at that, you wouldn't see this dramatic upward change. I mean, the point is, you want a bill. You're concerned about employer coercion, and you want a bill that takes away a secret ballot in favor of a public card check. And it seems to me there's an inherent contradiction there. You know, if you want to protect employees, you want a secret ballot. And historically, that was the union position. You don't want to use a public card unless you're going to try and keep the card secret, in which case then no one can challenge whether you've got 50.1% or, you know, don't have 50.1%. So it's a, you know, it becomes a public document. And it seems to me that creates more risk for individual employees than a secret ballot election. So I don't understand the remedy for the alleged wrong. I don't think the wrong is there. I think the act is working reasonably well. You know, but one can certainly look at the penalty structure. One can certainly look at time frames. One can look at staffing for the NLRB. You know, all of those are legitimate areas of inquiry.
Jim, did you have a comment?
If I may jump in, I sort of got charged or tasked with setting everything out there, so I didn't get into a whole lot of substance. I mean, I guess that's my one reaction to yours, Bill Samuel, was it seems in many ways you're critiquing, or the issue becomes conflating critiques about how campaigns can be waged with critique as to the final vote, the issue of the actual vote itself. I think from a lot of our members' perspective, you look at it and say, okay, if ultimately it's about coercion, retribution, the only thing that prohibits coercion or retribution, I mean, presumably you'd have an employer's, okay, you voted union, I'm going to punish all of you across the board. Well, you know, that's not permitted. But if I am the worker, you can press me every day and say, Peretti, if you don't vote for that, you vote for that union, you're not going to have a job, or you stay on the right side of the line, but you can press me to make sure you're... But at the end of the day, I can look my boss in the face and say, no, sir, I did not vote for that union. I'm the only one who knows if I'm telling the truth. So I guess to the extent, and Bill sort of alluded to it, if there are areas in which to explore campaigning and how the NLRA works, recognizing there is a tension between, you know, the private property rights and private speech rights of employers, there is more fertile ground and more credible ground to me than the argument that, well, you know, a secret ballot is subject to coercion. At the end of the day, it's the one thing that's not. And having sat there and, you know, had the NLRB agent walk me to the bathroom when we're all sitting at the... They do a pretty good job of maintaining that, an excellent job of maintaining a truly confidential ballot. So my two cents on that one.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and take a question from the audience.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm an employee benefits litigator here in town, so I'm very interested to see what your thoughts are on possible initiatives that the new administration might pursue in that area, especially considering that, according to the government's own estimate, the recent financial crisis has wiped out $2 trillion of value from retirement and pension funds.
Holly, why don't you start with that?
Well, I think you're right. There is such a need to look hard and long at the whole situation with benefits. I think from what we've seen, the energy is for healthcare to come first, and this has been my experience. I think it's sort of people's personal experience too. Is that the thing right before them is the health insurance? The thing way off in the future is the pension or the retirement savings, which is a huge public policy problem, because in my experience it has been very difficult to get the Congress and administrations across the board, Republican and Democrat, for decades to really focus on the retirement security issues. I know that that people are preparing for a very serious fight on health care reform. A lot of energy is going into that from all directions. So I think we will expect to see something in the first year. I think President-elect Obama does have a lot of good ideas about retirement savings. And I do think that there are members on the Hill who really care about this. I mean, Jim can speak more to it, but, you know, just right as we speak, Congress has been dealing with the issue of the Pension Protection Act and how to ease potentially some of the burdens that the financial crisis has put on pensions in terms of their funding obligations. So I think in the short term, there will be attention devoted to that issue, but I think we have a ways to go in figuring out some of the bigger solutions. Clearly, there will be some action next year, particularly from Chairman Miller, about fee disclosure. I think that is something that we can almost certainly count on will be on the agenda.
Anybody else, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, just to echo Holly's points, absolutely. With respect to Mr. Miller, he had proposed fee disclosure legislation this year, had moved it through the committee. We were expecting to see it on the floor, and I suspect it was a function of there not being complete consensus on their side of the aisle, as well as a looming campaign. This may not be the time you want to go stick, you know, pins in the eyes of folks who support you're trying to earn. In the short term, I expect we will try to do something with respect to, you know, just tweaking the Pension Protection Act, recognizing that in 2006 we tried to strike a balance between making sure companies fund to maintain the promises that they've made, that the PBGC doesn't end up too far on the hook, that multis are able to survive and hold on. None of us in the room, member staff, I think, ever would have anticipated 2 years later we'd be where we are. So there is a willingness both on Republican and Democrat side to say, okay, if that means, you know, playing with the dials and numbers a little bit, easing back on contributions, allowing for some freezes, some extensions, I sense a broad willingness to do that. We were very close to doing something this week, and it could have got held hostage to an entirely separate issue, and I'll leave it at that. But that's a short term. I do think longer term, plainly fee disclosure legislation, and I do think, you know, Mr. Miller comes to the table with a sort of assessment that the 401k system hasn't done everything that it's supposed to do. As we've moved from defined benefit to defined contribution, I don't know that they're seriously going to charge at the windmill of trying to bring back the era of the DB plan. I just don't know that ship may have sailed. But if we are in a DC world, what do we have to do to ensure that grows? And that's a challenge. I don't know that anybody's put out answers. We had a couple of hearings in the fall to sort of start laying out issues, and I would suggest to continue a drumbeat of, you know, the economy, served their purposes very well. But there is a recognition that, you know, some action is going to have to be taken. Also, with the respect to the code, you'll see probably some ability for folks who may be otherwise required to have taken withdrawals to maybe juice those nest eggs back up. And ultimately, I think everybody's still playing a little bit of you know, Keynes. The market is going to come back. We just hope it gets there, you know, sooner rather than later. You know, enough said on that point for me.
Bill Samuel.
I would just say none of the proposals that are being seriously considered right now are commensurate with the scale of the problem. And I think we're about to see a generation of Americans retire with very little to fall back on. Social Security, everybody will have. But their own savings, either individually in bank accounts or through their 401ks or IRAs, are probably not going to be enough. They certainly are not replacing the benefits that were available under the traditional defined benefit plan, which most of our parents have probably retired on. And I think it's a crisis that's right around the corner. I don't have the answer. I think we would love to see a return, obviously, to the world of defined benefit pensions. But I don't think that may not be in the cards in the short term. But I don't think we've seen the worst of this yet, and it's going to be affecting a lot of people in this room, I suspect.
I would just point out, by way of footnote, the law of unintended consequences. Yet again, watch what you regulate. We passed the Pension Protection Act 2 years ago, and that's the law that people are now seeking to amend, because it puts a burden on employers and the ability of employers to fund their defined benefit plans that is truly enormous when you have an economic downturn like this and the assets in the plan have lost as much value as assets have lost in the last couple of years. The problem with defined benefit plans is not the defined benefit plan. It is the regulatory burdens that have provided an incentive for employers to move away from DB plans.
Finally, something Bill and I agree on.
There you go.
Thank you. Let's take another question.
You want to join me in a spirited defense of the Pension Protection Act? Shall we move on?
The lions and the lambs are sitting down together like in Colorado. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Michael Barton, Sugarland, Texas. When I was working trade issues on the Hill, labor issues came up a lot. And I specifically remember George Miller sending a letter in 2001 to the government of Mexico, along with being signed by a whole bunch of other like-minded people, saying that the secret ballots for union elections was absolutely essential, and Mexico should do that, and Mexico should keep it. So my question is, why is it essential and vital for Mexican unions to have secret ballots, but it's okay for us not to have secret ballots?
My understanding of the situation in Mexico, obviously it's a completely different system, but the elections there are between unions. It's not whether to have a union or not have a union. I think, and that, in fact, that's...
Isn't the principle the same, though?
No, well, it's typically the case here, too. In the early days, the National Labor Relations Act did not involve elections. Workers for many years formed unions with cards. And by the way, this notion that cards are public and you stand up on a platform and sign it and everybody sees, the only way you can get started now is by signing cards. You all know how you begin an organizing drive. You have to sign at least 30% of the members up on cards to get to an election. By the way, the Employee Free Choice Act does not eliminate secret ballot elections. In any case, it's still an option for workers if that's what they want. But no, it's not the same thing. If you're choosing between unions, I'm not sure how you would do it with a card, but the election is as good a way as any to do it. But that's our criticism is not the election. Our criticism is the campaign. I mean, I really have to emphasize that. And you know, the Soviet Union had elections. Zimbabwe had elections, secret ballot elections. But nobody thought they were fair. Nobody thought there was any free choice associated with them. That's what I'm trying to get across.
Go ahead. Yes, sir.
I had a couple issues I'd be interested in comment on. One is often the beginning of administration is preoccupied with addressing issues that were important in the prior administration. So I'm curious whether, for example, Bill and Holly see things that have been done in this administration that it's important from their perspective for an Obama administration to take another look at and perhaps roll back. And then secondly, to the extent there's time and interest, I'm curious the extent to which the recent and ever more dramatic economic downturn causes any of you to reconsider what might have seemed a very wise priority, say, 6 months ago, but now it seems to be perhaps a disruption or cost that can't be dealt with. If I follow the story correctly, for example, the president has now come to support an extension of unemployment benefits, which I think he initially was opposing. I could see maybe increased unpaid leave as a way of spreading jobs around in a way that overtime pay might have been used during the New Deal. But on the other hand, an increase in the minimum wage seems even more extravagant when you're in a deflationary cycle. So I'll stop there.
Holly, why don't you start on that?
Well, in terms of the first part of your question, one thing that I just read about in my daily labor report this morning that I think fits into that category, which is a policy regulatory issue that the current administration and the future administration disagree about, I think, although to the extent which they disagree, we'll see, has to do with these regulations on the Family Medical Leave Act that the Bush administration just put out. So I know among the interest groups, they have been contentious. I have no idea what the approach will be, but I think that sort of falls into the category of a difference of opinion, which is highlighted because it's coming so close to the end of this administration.
I mean, there are some probably executive orders that we would like to see reversed, the Project Labor Agreements executive order, the Beck posting. But your other question is more intriguing because I think it's much more in the news these days, and I guess I would relate it back to the Employee Free Choice Act. Can we afford it now? A lot of people are saying this is the wrong time to burden business with more union organizing and potentially higher payroll costs. I guess the way I look at it is that if we're going to have a consumer-led recovery, two-thirds of our economy is consumers, we've got to put money back in people's pockets. You know, we've had this long-running dispute with Walmart, which I think everybody would agree pays fairly low wages. That's how they can sell inexpensive products. you know, imagine, you know, we're all going to be talking probably 2 months from now about a tax cut for middle-income workers. A year ago, it was rebates. We had to give everybody back $300 or $600 so they go out and buy something. Well, imagine if Walmart, instead of paying $6.15 an hour, was paying $8.50 an hour. We think to get back to a consumer-led economy, consumer-led recovery, we've got to give workers back the ability to keep up with inflation and the cost of living. And right now, I mean, I'll get back to this notion that we wages are flatlining and have been since the 1970s. That's a fact. Or, you know, average weekly earnings have not gone up in a long time. So anyway, people can disagree with whatever the solution is, but I think the issue you raise is going to be very much in the news. Unions didn't put Circuit City out of business, and they certainly didn't bring down Lehman Brothers. So, you know, maybe you can say they brought down the big three. I don't know. I think they made pretty lousy decisions about the kind of cars they were selling. If it's true that Toyota pays about the same and provides health insurance, then why are they surviving? Detroit's not. Is it work rules? I think it's the fact that they made crummy decisions in the boardroom, not at Solidarity House, where the UAW is headquartered.
Thank you. I have a question for Bill Kilberg, and I'm curious about the role that, you know, business is going to play with the new Congress, the new president. In a recent column in the Wall Street Journal by Thomas Frank, he quotes the chairman of Home Depot as expressing the view that the business class might rediscover its ancestral zeal for combat, and Frank sums up his article by saying liberals should take heed. If they thought the Harry and Louise campaign that sank Hillary Clinton's health care reform was dirty, they should know they ain't seen nothing yet. What do you see business, the Chamber of Commerce, what role are they going to be playing in the next 6 months, 12 months?
I have not seen the business community as organized and as revved up as they are now with regard specifically to the Employee Free Choice Act since Carter administration labor law reform. And I have to tell you, that amazed me because, you know, I was in government during the 1970s, left before the Carter administration came in. And during those years, I mean, you just couldn't get business or to do anything together, and it's been pretty much the same since then. I mean, it's a very divided world with a large variety of interests, and rare that you can pull them together. This would organize them, and has done so. That's why I started my comments out by saying that I'm impressed with the Obama administration transition to date. I think they have. I was impressed with their campaign, obviously, seeing it from the other side. We thought they ran a heck of a good campaign. I think they're running a very, very good transition. They're showing themselves to be very sophisticated, very smart, putting into place people who are experienced, can hit the ground running. Therefore, my guess is they're going to want to buy some time and not have an issue which is so controversial and so divisive for their opening battle. That doesn't mean that I'm predicting that the president-elect is going to give up on the issue, but I think it'll probably come a little later than we now think. That's just my guess.
Yeah, and on this one, Bill, I think I'll disagree. Very brief aside, to establish my credibility on this issue, back in 2007, I was over in Tokyo addressing a room full of Japanese parliamentarians and staff, and I stated with absolute and complete certainty my conviction that in the 2008 election, Hillary Clinton would narrowly edge out Mitt Romney to become the next president of the United States. So given my great prognosticating skills, I do think that it will come up sooner rather than later. I think, one, there's going to be, you know, as much as people want to say, oh, we want to be strategic, we don't want to take on. This is, you know, there's a lot of juice moving for them on this right now, and I expect Bill and his colleagues will push hard on that. There is also the practical matter for some of these members, particularly Southern Democrats. If you think it's something you're not going to, not a vote you're going to enjoy living with, rip the Band-Aid off sooner rather than later. Why let the drumbeat build? It amazes me still, particularly in the House, that it seems you're 6 months into a calendar year, and already folks are thinking about the election that's 18 months ahead. So we'll see how that one goes. I think there's arguments on both sides.
You make good points.
Phil, how does labor try to bridge some of these differences and work together?
On timing? I'm not tipping my hand on that.
Early and often.
Yeah, question from the audience.
Well, you mentioned controversial. You mentioned a law initiative that reminded me of Duran Duran in the 1980s, comparable worth. How serious are the powers to be at doing something with comparable worth?
Holly?
Haven't talked to anybody lately. Don't know that I can really answer that question. You know, there are basically three different proposals on the table, I think, that have to do with equal pay issues. I think only one really could be fairly put in the category of comparable worth. This is a bill that Senator Harkin is the lead sponsor of, and I think Holmes Norton is the lead sponsor. Is that right, Jim?
Yeah.
Right. But there's the range, right? There's fixing Ledbetter, which I think people have alluded to. The votes are probably there as we speak for that. And then there's an intermediate version, which is the Paycheck Fairness Act, which is something that Senator Clinton had been a lead sponsor of. And Jim, who is the lead in that?
It's Rosa DeLauro
on
the Equal Pay Act stuff. And if
right.
I can, I think we can interact. It's a shame we can't kind of look at each other.
I can't see
you said right. There are sort of three proposals. Only one could pay equity proposals. Only one could be comparable worth. I would also sort of counter by saying I don't think the Ledbetter bill can be viewed as is not really an equal pay bill. As I said, the messaging on that was done very, very well. It was tied hand in glove to the point that we've been marked up and moved that DeLauro-Clinton paycheck fairness bill so as to tie the issues together. But at the end of the day, and we can argue about whether, well, that was always the rule and the Supreme Court changed it, it really is much more of a statute of limitations question. And my fear, and because the question was put to us, if this has been the rule in many circuits, has this really been such a big problem? My concern is that by sort of focusing the issue, expanding it, you have, and people try to step away from it, but under Ledbetter, which I agree with you, I think the votes are there, you have an employment and action that takes place in 2010. You work for another 30 years, and you look back and say, gee, I've been getting percentage increases all these years that would have been higher if I hadn't, faced an allegation of discrimination in 2010. You got a 30-year look back. Go another 20 years, retire out of the system, and whether it's a defined contribution match or a DB, for the ones that are still around, hey, my pension would have been higher but for that act of discrimination 50 years back, which has a tangible, I allege has a tangible impact on my salary. I am concerned that it opens the door very, very broadly. I recognize, Ms. Ledbetter, who was a very articulate advocate in a very sympathetic case. And I understand she brought an Equal Pay Act claim in the lower court, but her case was not an equal – it wasn't an Equal Pay – Ledbetter was not an Equal Pay Act case. At its heart, Ledbetter was a sexual harassment case a Title VII case. But I will give it to the supporters. They've done a great job of tying those two together. But I feel very strongly about Ledbetter, that it's sort of been mischaracterized.
Do you see any momentum on the comparable worth issue?
I think they'll try. I think when we start talking about what can be done and what, where do you start peeling off? If there's three tiers, Ledbetter, Equal Pay Act, comparable worth, will we get we'll be big people and take comparable worth off the table, so now you can support Ledbetter and equal pay? What a good deal that is. Maybe.
Yes, sir.
James Sherrick with the Heritage Foundation. The secret ballot issue has obviously attracted most of the attention on EFCA. And when I talk to business leaders, it's the binding arbitration provision that just terrifies them. And my question is, if you've got the government writing the labor contract for the first 2 years and specifying you'll hire X number of workers at X rates for this amount of time, it starts to look an awful lot like a temporary nationalization of the company. And you could get into issues of a takings without compensation. And I'm an economist, not a lawyer, so my question for the lawyers is, how strong a constitutional challenge is there, do you think, to the binding arbitration side of the bill?
Well, I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I mean, the only thing I would say about that provision, again, this is a problem that we think is a serious one that needs to be addressed. In a third of the successful
organizing campaigns, a first contract is never agreed to. There are very weak incentives for an employer to agree to a first contract. Basically, what happens if they drag their feet or they bargain hard is they get an order eventually to go back to the table and keep bargaining. And that can go on for a long time, and workers get dispirited, and maybe after a year there's an effort to decertify the union. So there's not much in the law that really pushes either side to get an agreement, but that the incentive, I think, really is lacking for businesses. In Canada, in the provinces where they have first a binding arbitration, it's very rarely used. It really acts as an encouragement, a pressure on both sides to agree. Nobody wants to leave it up to a third party to negotiate the terms of agreement, not the employer, not the union. You know, in most of these situations, they're choosing terms that one or the other has recommended, which it tends to push them toward the center in the first place, because you don't know which terms they're going to choose. On wages, people think, well, the union's going to put these extravagant provisions out. What if the arbitrator chooses that? It's going to put the company out of business. Well, these are professional people, these arbitrators. They're not going to choose the extravagant one. They're going to look for the one that's sort of in the middle. So it forces both sides, if they're going to get to arbitration, to put contract terms out that are close, because they're going to run the risk that they're going to lose out in arbitration. But the main point I want to leave is it's very rarely utilized where they have it. But I can't just give you the answer to whether it's constitutional or not.
Yeah, Bill, how would you assess the constitutional challenges?
There are a number of constitutional challenges that can be made. It's hard to assess how strong the arguments will be ultimately. But some of us have been looking at this issue. In terms of the viability of arbitration, I mean, you know, this is an undefined arbitration procedure. It's left to the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service. It's not clear whether these arbitrators are private arbitrators, public arbitrators, whether we're talking about a board or a panel, which is what's referred to in the law, but there's no mandate that it be that. And my experience is, short of baseball arbitration, which is a very special kind of arbitration where the arbitrator can choose one contract, one set of proposals or the other, the effect of knowing that arbitration is at the end of the road is not to bargain, but rather to posture for purposes of the eventual arbitration. I think the common wisdom, at least in the United States, has been that having these kinds of provisions undercuts rather than encourages the collective bargaining process.
Yes, ma'am.
Betsy Dorminey from Georgia. As long as you all are prognosticating, what do you see on the horizon for immigrant and non-immigrant legal and illegal workers that are in the country or coming to the country?
Who wants to take that?
That's a tough one. Well, go ahead.
Jim?
I recognize it's a small question and it'd only take a couple minutes to answer.
Isn't there a panel on immigration?
I assume there's going to be another run at an immigration bill.
Yeah, I can't give it terribly much more. I wasn't expecting the question, I'll be blunt, so I hadn't given it much thought before getting here. Curious. There was the highlighted, you know, Obama-McCain meeting earlier this week, and there's been the discussion, you know, is there an issue on which Barack Obama will reach out to John McCain and putting back on his dealmaker hat or trying to navigate the shoals, would this be that issue? I don't know. It seems like the issue itself has ebbed a little bit. Curious if the economy continues down, if it's going to sort of reassert itself. But for a while it was front and center, and then other issues sort of got eclipsed. But I think they'll take a run at it. I don't know that you'll see piecemeal again. It might be in an effort to get that sort of more comprehensive. But it is a fractious issue because it both on the Republican and Democrat side, it splits rather than down party lines. It splits across regions. It splits across economic. So I don't know that anyone's in a rush to take it up. And at the same time, there is enough else going on that folks can plausibly say, hey, that can't be, you know, getting the economy right, restoring the market, blah, you know, name off your five things, you know, come at a higher level of priority. So I guess if I were prognosticating, I would say I do not see this being a front and center issue, at least in the near to midterm of the next Congress.
Polly, would you agree from your years on the Hill?
That really does feel to me like a fair assessment of it. There are so many people who really do care and want to get this issue right. And we've seen very serious policy and political development of it. People coming together, members, my old boss, Senator Kennedy, working very closely with Senator McCain, Lindsey Graham, you know, a nice array of members. But I do feel like the time is not right, and it may take a while to put it back together again.
Yeah. Other questions? One topic that we moved through fairly quickly was the Respect Act, which would make changes to the regarding the classification of supervisors and employees. I wonder if the panel could assess the merits of that and where it might be on the to-do list for the next Congress.
Well, we still think it's something that needs to be addressed. Obviously, the law was unclear, and the Supreme Court, you know, wanted the board to go back and try to bring some clarity to the problem. We think they went overboard. I mean, giving companies too much latitude to reclassify workers as supervisors, particularly in the healthcare field. I've heard from a lot of our unionized nurses that companies are using, that hospital chains and healthcare providers are using this to exclude them from the potential bargaining unit if there's an organizing drive going on. And it seems like on some pretty flimsy pretexts, if they help with scheduling one day a week. I can't remember what the threshold is in terms of how much time they have to work on scheduling before they're considered a supervisor, but they really don't have the what you would normally think of as supervisory duties. They can't hire, fire, evaluate, reassign, that sort of thing. They may, in a rotating way, work on scheduling. And I think under the Oakwood decisions, and this is now a couple of years old, that by itself might be enough to categorize them as a supervisor. We think it was a pretty clear attempt to, you know, deny union rights to a lot of people, and so we do think it ought to be reversed, and it's high up on our list for this Congress.
From our perspective, I think I don't want to say the jury's still out, because on the Respect Act, our members certainly had significant concerns with some of the bill's provisions, which, given that it's about six lines, doesn't take much. But in particular, I mean, I would highlight each of the three. I mean, you're talking about the designation of a supervisor and removing from the list of tasks assign and direct. And at the same time, the requirement of a majority of time, to me, really, you know, fundamentally threatens the concept of the working supervisor in any context. I would say this is reminiscent to me of the overtime debate back in 2003 and 2004. Oh, if these regulations become final, 8 million people are going to lose overtime overnight. It's been 4 years. I haven't met one of them. I'm sure you'll be happy to find me one, and I decline. Don't have to today. But I do think also we've yet to see if this standard has had the sort of chilling effect that I think supporters of the Respect Act said it would. Oh, overnight we're going to see millions of workers change from being rank and file to supervisors. In the three cases at issue, I mean, it was 12 out of 181, 0 out of 55, and 0 out of 30. I know there are responses to that, but in the short term, I think, you know, no one has come to us and shown credible numbers to say, boy, this has gone too far the other way. My thought.
Either one of you? Next question from the audience.
My name is Brad Tupi. I come from Pittsburgh, a city that has sustained just a tremendous amount of damage from unionism.
With that preface.
Our football team's named after an industry that doesn't exist in Pittsburgh anymore, and my dad was a member of that union. Mr. Samuel, if the problem with union organizing in the workplace is an unfair balance of communication between employer on the one hand and union on the other, then I would think your remedy would have to do with allowing for more union communication with the employees. Card check doesn't do that. Card check means that a guy bigger than me brings the card to me to sign, and when I say no, he brings it to me again with his buddy. And when I say no again, it means that my car gets vandalized. And when I say no again, my children in school are threatened. That's what it means. So the remedy doesn't match the problem.
Bill?
Well, you know, it's a nice fairy tale you tell. I don't know how much experience since 1935 you have, or the board has, or any employer has, with that type of situation. Most of these organizing drives are among coworkers. It's not a union organizer the union organizer rarely has access to the workers themselves. These are coworkers who have very little control over any leverage, certainly coercive power. Since 1935, I think there have been something like 42 cases where a union has been guilty of doing exactly what you say, and that's compared to the 15,000, 20,000 a year, or less, depending on how you define it. I think there is a lot of debate about statistics, but there isn't a lot of empirical evidence that the situation you describe and the business community likes to use in commercials with The Sopranos actually happens, because we get the death penalty if we do it. The election's thrown out. If there's any evidence that there were threats, physical or otherwise, by a union organizer, and that comes to light, the board finds it, the election is over and you lose. It's not the same thing for the employer, by the way, because they've already won. So the only penalty for them is they might have to rerun the election, like Smithfield has run it I don't know how many times in North Carolina. So, again, it's you paint a very grim picture. I don't know what kind of empirical evidence you have, if you know anybody that's happened to. And to say that the labor movement killed the steel industry is bizarre. I mean, Japanese imports and competition, globalization killed the steel industry. And by the way, it's roaring back with a lot of unionized workers. It's doing quite well now. And you talk to the steel workers, they worked with the steel industry to rebuild it, to reconstitute it, to become a very competitive industry.
Bill, any comment?
Take it from the rear. We produce as much steel, more steel, actually, in the United States today than we did 30 years ago. And we do it with 75% fewer workers. And there's blame to go around. It was the continuous caster was an American invention that was turned down by Bethlehem Steel Corporation and then U.S. Steel Corporation. And they ended up taking it to Japan. The Japanese thought it was a good idea and began to eat our lunch. But at the same time, we've had Brook rules in that industry, in the auto industry, that have helped to make these industries non-competitive. And we have to, if we're going to tell the story, we have to tell it right, and we have to put the blame where the blame belongs. Especially if we're going to do it right the next time around. On the 42 cases, the problem with that is you get any group of management labor attorneys together and we all have stories. Sometimes they're hard to prove. Sometimes they're resolved at the ALJ level. So they don't get up to the board, but we all have those stories, and they are part of human nature too. And it is just as I would not believe the union side if you said that in a situation where people crossed the picket line, you had line crossers, that there was no retribution. No threats of violence, many instances of violence. I got to tell you, you get a card check situation, it's hard to believe that there hasn't been that kind of pressure on the union side. We've all seen it.
Well, since 2000, I think, about 500,000 workers have organized through card check. And you all know that it's illegal. Employers can recognize cards now. They've been able to since the original passage of the Act. So voluntary recognition exists in practice. Unfortunately, it's now up to the employer whether to accept it. That's the other point I didn't make initially. Why should the employer get to decide how workers organize, secret ballot or card check, majority sign-up? So it happens now every day. Most organizing is through voluntary recognition. Workers have given up on the board. Unions have pretty much given up. Much more organizing goes on through voluntary recognition. And again, I'm not aware of this of a lot of examples where among those 500,000 workers at AT&T Wireless, Harley-Davidson, Freightliner, Kaiser Permanente, they all use card check, that people were threatened or coerced or bullied into signing cards. And in fact, by the way, you can always decertify, so people are really unhappy and it goes on as often as you think. That union's not going to last very long. In fact, most organizers are told, you got to be liked by these people. You got to go in and be liked, trusted. Because they're putting their lives in your hands, or at least their job, because it's so risky to vote for a union. So I just think this notion that there are these scary people out there threatening workers is it may happen, but I don't know much.
There's also just the plain peer pressure too, and it's not the same as having the opportunity to have a secret ballot where you go in, nobody knows how you voted, and you vote whatever you feel your conscience, however your conscience directs.
People join all kinds of organizations these days without secret ballots, and maybe there's peer pressure involved. I think most adults are not, are able to deal with that. People knock on your door all the time trying to sell you things, trying to get you to sign up to things. We haven't made that illegal. It's not a... People don't take that threat seriously.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead,
Jim. I was just going to say, in the only bright spot, which was an otherwise lousy week for me, as Louise Slaughter said, thank the Lord for a secret ballot.
I didn't want to do this as a sum up. This was just a point. And that is that when we talk about the voluntary card check situations, too often those have been the result in recent years of corporate campaigns. I mean, and corporate campaigns that themselves are coercive. I mean, we ought to be able to have a system where employees have the right to decide for themselves whether to join or not to join, a union. And we ought not to assume that the decision not to join is automatically the result of coercion.
We have time for one last quick question.
Yes, I'd like to know if any proposals are being considered regarding teacher unions. Mr. Peretti, maybe you might know something about that.
I'm not aware of any proposals specifically regarding teacher unions. I think on the education side, the issue I would most expect to see action on in under Mr. Miller's watch would be potentially organizing with graduate students in graduate education, or whether the board will revisit those decisions. I'm certainly not aware of any legislation directed at teachers' unions.
I mean, they're not covered.
I was going to say, right, they're not exactly. It's on a, on a state basis. So, we've had a couple of high profile examinations of teacher union scandals and such in D.C. I know that's aroused a lot of folks, but I'm not aware of any federal legislation that would be, aiming towards that way.
Well, thank you, panel. It was a very intriguing and interesting conversation.